Okay, so we're going to start walking through our programming exercises today. We'll spend the next couple of weeks working on that in parallel to you guys developing your designs for the final project. So before we get started on the programming piece of things, now that you've had a chance to think about what we talked about on Tuesday a little bit and hopefully look at the rules and everything that's been posted, you guys have questions? They can clarify. Yes, sir. No. So if you read the details about that, right, that's about the full contest. But there shouldn't be, that's the problem understanding report, right? It's on the 15th. So the problem understanding report is just the problem understanding. So there's no designs in that at all. But it is towards the full contest. All the reports are towards the full set of rules of full contest. Yes, of course. Yeah, I think, in fact, it says on the outline there should be no designs in this report at all, if you look at it. Other questions?
The mechanical device is going to start in the place in the start zone.
So the individual competition, does it have to start in the start zone? Yes. All rules apply unless otherwise stated. So, yes, you have to start within that 2x2 zone for all the contests. And remember, that includes the volume of air above it. So it's not just touching the ground within the 2x2, it's completely contained within the 2x2. When you start, of course, you can and probably have to expand after that, move in some way.
And then for the track, the only thing extruded up the track is that middle piece. Everything else is flat.
Everything else is flat. The entire track is flat except for the middle Churchill Downs. Questions? All right. So at this point, what I'm going to ask of you guys for this one class and this one class only, close your laptops, put your phones away, and really listen today. Okay. I usually, if you don't want to listen normally, that's on you. I don't necessarily care. You're wasting your time. Not mine. Okay. But today is so critical to largely the enjoyment of the rest of the class for you. Right? If we don't get what we're working through today and we're not paying attention and understanding just the very basics of what we talked through today, everything from here on out is going to be way worse for you. Right? And not just way worse for you, but way worse for your team as well. Okay. So please try to pay attention. If you have questions along the way, ask questions. Of course, I'll be asking you guys questions like I normally do, but please ask questions. We need to get the core foundation of what we're going to do down today if we're going to understand anything moving forward. Okay. So, we're going to talk about MicroPython largely today. We'll talk just a bit about your board itself, and then some structures in MicroPython that pretty much everything we see today is also valid pure Python, with a few rare exceptions. Right. So this would work on your desktop computer. And in fact, we're going to run a lot of the code on my computer here to show you exactly what's going to happen. So this MicroPython port, it's a port of the language called Python to run on microcontrollers. And it's a pretty thorough port, meaning it has most of the same functions of the core Python library. Okay. Syntax is the same. It's a pretty well done project. And the initial board release that runs it, there are plenty of them now, was this Pi board. So this is kind of an image of version 1. You guys have version 1.1. So, Pi board looks something like that. It's the part of your kit. It has four onboard LEDs. So you have a red one that's actually LED 1. Green ones it called LED 2 internally. LED 3 is the yellow one, and LED 4 is the blue one. So the red and green are just on-off. The 3 and 4 we actually can vary the brightness, and we'll talk about how to do that a little bit later. Intensity of how bright they are. Okay. There are two onboard little push buttons for you. There's one that's labeled RST that's a reset button, which completely resets the board. Okay. You generally want to avoid pressing that if you can help it. All right. The other is labeled USR for user. This is a user button, so you can use this in your code to set different modes and things like that. You can read that button in runtime. You also have on your board an onboard accelerometer. It's this little chip here. When you guys take me for vibrations, we'll learn how that works actually internally. Just talked about it the other day. So that can get the acceleration of your board, but then actually from that accelerometer also we can get the tilt. So that can actually be useful for your robot. If you know where your board's mounted, you can understand the motion of your robot from onboard the Pi board itself. At the heart of this thing is actually a STM32 processor. It's an ARM-based processor. It's STM32F405. So most of you guys' smartphones are running ARM family processors. A bit more powerful than this one, but the same family of processors. So that's the core of the board. It actually has a micro SD slot. Right? So this processor and the board itself has a small bit of memory for us to store code in. And for this class, most of what, you know, pretty much everything we're going to do can be stored in the onboard flash of the board itself. However, if you have a micro SD card inserted, it will try to run code from that first, actually. So that can be if you need more space and things like that. You can run code directly from the micro SD card. It's actually a nice way to log information. You can log directly, write files to that SD card from this controller. So there's a micro SD slot, and then there's the USB. Okay. So why Python? And we use Python. I use Python in my lab. I use Python and just mentioned vibrations. When I teach controls, we use Python instead of MATLAB. And this summarizes one reason why I do that. Right. So this is a chart, kind of a proxy of program language popularity since 2012. So the dark red solid line you see here is Python, right? Some other kind of common ones, C++ is pretty much flat. You'll see that JavaScript is creeping up a little bit. We're doing web pages. Actually, an increasing amount of that being used on servers as well. C#, which is a Microsoft language, is kind of going down. PHP is out of favor, not real popular right now. But Python is going the opposite way. Okay. So this is a nice language for that reason. You guys are learning something that's kind of on the way up and popular. And I think it's also a nice first language. Most of you guys have not programmed yet, right? So I think it's a nice first language to learn. I think you'll find the syntax fairly simple and straightforward. But there's a complexity there if you need it. We'll talk more about that in a bit. The other question that gets asked for a class like this is, hey, why aren't you using Arduino? Which is probably the most popular one of these little microcontroller boards we're using. So why not Arduino? Well, one is the slide you just saw. Python is a general purpose language. Right? The Arduino language is a subset of C or C++, depending on how you want to slice it. So what you learn in terms of Arduino programming is not directly applicable in most other places. Python is, right? So most of the backside server stuff at Instagram was written in Python when they first started. I think they've switched over now since they're much larger. Google uses Python extensively. They have tons and tons of Python libraries. Most of Google's machine learning algorithms, the kind of front side interface of those, is written in Python. Okay? So it's used in a lot of places. It's in the machine learning community, which is a really hot area right now. Python is the dominant language by far. It's also used in a very large number of robotics libraries and tools. There's one my lab uses extensively called ROS. So you can write in C++ or Python. So we use ROS. There's another huge number of tools built around this scientific Python stack. That's what we would use in vibrations or controls if you take me for that. And if you're interested in why I kind of push for Python in the classroom, you can check that article out. The other reason is that the Pi board, the board you guys bought, is significantly more powerful than a similarly priced Arduino. In terms of processing capabilities, I/O latency, the analog to digital conversion, which you can learn about all that stuff. So I think it's a better value as well. Okay, so what is our system setup? We're going to do this. Python is what's called an interpreted language, meaning we don't have to take some code and compile it and then run it, right? It runs just the code directly, kind of, right? So the way we'll edit our code is just in a plain text editor. We don't need anything really special in order to write Python code. Okay. There are many options for plain text editors and IDEs, integrated developer environments. And you talk to people that program professionally, they get into arguments about which one of these is best. Just like they'll get into arguments about what font your editor should be using, et cetera. Okay. The one we're going to use and what you'll see screenshots of me using, I think it's a good language, a good, nice platform for us to get started on, is one called Visual Studio Code. It has some nice plugins you can get that highlight and work well with Python. Right, so it's available for Mac, Windows, and Linux as well. So that's another reason we can all be seeing something fairly similar across all platforms. Okay. So, we'll mention it again at the end of lecture today, but by this time next week, you should have that guy installed. It's free. Grab it, you know. So, get it installed. And by this time next week, you probably also want to bookmark or have saved somewhere the reference documentation for the MicroPython and the PyBoard. Okay. So, there's the full documentation there. There's kind of this quick reference page at that link. And the reason you want to have those bookmarked and ready to go is that you're not going to remember all the syntax for every function available on the PyBoard and within Python. Right? I don't remember that. And in fact, I think most programmers that write Python every day don't remember every syntax, every order of operations, everything. Right? The way they work and the way I work is if you don't remember something, you have to look it up. Right? Don't guess at what it should be and things like that. So it's really common to have your code editor open in one window and the documentation right next to it, side by side. Okay. So this is a key point. Don't guess at what the syntax should be or what the function name should be or those function signatures should be, those things. Have these ready to go. It's easy to search, find it, and then you get it right the first time. Okay. And that's how this is done in practice. Okay. And the more you do it, the more of it you remember, and the less you have to look up. But still, we'll have to look up some stuff. Right? Okay. So, again, I'll mention this at the end of class today, but and these links are active in the PDFs always, so you can just click on it in the PDF if you want to get these things installed. And there'll be one more piece of software to install before next week as well. Okay. Connecting to the PyBoard. So once we have our system set up, connecting to the PyBoard, I think this is also, in my opinion, a bit more convenient than using an Arduino. It shows up actually as just like a USB flash drive when you plug it in. Right, there's that micro SD connector on there. You plug it into your computer. It shows up as a flash drive called PYB Flash. Okay. And what comes from the factory on that disk are these files. There's one called boot.py, so you see files with a .py extension. Those are Python files. Okay. They're actually just plain text, but Python.py is the convention. Okay. We have boot.py, main.py, a readme file, that's just a plain text file, and this pybcdc. Okay. Pretty much the only one of these files we'll be modifying and changing is main. That's where the main part of your code goes. As you might expect, boot is what runs when the board first starts up, when it boots up. So it runs that file. As soon as it's finished with whatever's in boot, it jumps to main and runs that. Okay. So that's what the PyBoard looks like from the factory. That when you plug yours in for the first time, it'll come up something like that. So these are the default factory files. They're not hard to get if you need them, but before you do anything else, take those files, drag them into a folder somewhere on your computer. Okay? Grab a copy of those. Things get messed up, you can always just drag them back onto the PyBoard and start fresh. Okay? So before you do anything else, this is another thing. Do before you come to class next week. Okay, once you get your editor installed, save those files somewhere. Okay. A warning when you're looking at these files. We're not going to edit that main py, the main.py file from the board. Like, we're not going to open it directly from the Py board. What we're going to do is have a local copy of main.py that we edit. Then we'll drag it over to the flash drive and then run it. Okay? So, as I said, we're going to work on a local version of main.py, or if you're making any changes to boot.py, which you can do, we really don't do that much. Then you're going to copy it over to the Py board. Okay? And then we'll show how to run it once you copy it. Talk through that. Before you unplug the Py board, it just looks like a flash drive, right? Most USB flash drives these days, you can just unplug them and you'll be fine almost all the time, right? The Py board is not quite as robust to that. The flash memory on the Py board is a bit more fragile, but more likely to corrupt than a normal flash drive. So make sure that you inject or unmount the Py board, that flash drive, the PYB flash, before you unplug your Py board. Okay. Same thing with hitting that reset button. The reset button effectively unplugs, it reboots the board. It looks to your disk, looks to your computer like it got ejected and plugged right back in. Okay. So if you have to use that reset button, go in and eject or disconnect or unmount that PYB flash before you hit the button. You guys got that? This has actually ended up being a pretty big source of problems, right? Because people edit directly on the flash, and then that file gets corrupted, and things go bad from there. It's a kind of a little bit hard problem to debug if you haven't seen that before. Okay. So this is going to be our workflow, largely. Excuse me. On Windows, there may be one more step. When you plug it in, you're probably going to be prompted, hey, do you want to install some drivers and stuff for this board? Okay. The first time it asks you about that, cancel it. Don't do that, because you actually probably don't need to install those drivers. Okay. So you want to try to connect first. And again, you're likely not going to have to install those drivers. We'll talk about how to connect in a minute. Okay. However, if you do need to install the driver, it is that pybcdc.inf file on the Py board itself is the driver for it. And then the instructions on how to install it if you need it are here as well. But again, I think if you're Windows 10 or newer, original Windows 10, first version of 10, you shouldn't need this driver, which is probably most of you guys at this point. It's been out a while. Okay. Questions so far? Yes, sir?
Does a robot need multiple Py boards because it can be
engineered? So the question was, hey, can a robot use multiple Py boards? Who's read the rules? Can you use, how many can we use? One, just one on your final design. Okay. So you have multiple Py boards because we're going to be working individually through the programming. It's helpful that your entire team knows how to program, right? There's a large number of senior design teams using the Py board in their senior design project this semester because they come ask me questions. I know. Yes, sir.
I remember teams talking about some parts getting short circuited or something going bad.
So on the Py board, there's only really one way that you're going to see what side mine 9. There's only one way you're going to burn up the board itself, and that is this 3v3 line. You can see top right there. There's another one here that we'll occasionally use. If that touches ground, the voltage regulator on this board goes poof. Okay, which you might expect, right? It's jumping all the current it can to ground. It's going to burn up, right? Everything else is fairly robust. So that's the one way, if you touch those two guys, or the two up there, that this is fairly fragile. Otherwise, it's pretty tough. You probably heard more, and probably what they're referencing is the motor driver. The overwhelming majority of problems with those motor drivers are user error. And teams doing something similar and connecting the two leads of the motor together, accidentally typically. And again, you're pulling infinite current effectively. So that burns those drivers up pretty well. But hopefully that's not going to be an issue this semester either, because you guys are way better than them, right? But we also have some new components that we're probably going to help with that. Okay, so we got through that one. So we're actually going to work quite extensively in something that's called a REPL, R-E-P-L. Okay. When we talk to the board, right, only we can interact with the board in real time. This is another nice feature that the Arduino doesn't have. It's called a read, evaluate, print loop. Okay. So we can type commands in one by one on the Pi board and run them one by one on the Pi board, rather than having to compile some program always to run it, which is, I think, fairly helpful when you're learning. So it looks something like a text, you know, like the text editor. There are many options for how you can connect to the board serially. Here's a list of some on the Mac. And here's a list of some on Windows. If you have a Linux box, I'm sure you can figure it out. So you might notice that there's kind of one in both places, right? It's a cool term. So again, like Visual Studio Code text editor, I'm going to suggest that you get CoolTerm. Right? This is the other piece of software you need to have installed when you walk into class next week, if you're bringing your laptop and want to follow along. Okay. So I can pull that up. This website looks a little shady. It is not. Let's see. Okay. All right. So CoolTerm, Mac, Windows, Linux, all you need. So we all going to have something that looks pretty similar, has similar settings and things like that. Okay. So, and it's a pretty well done piece of software. It's pretty solid. So we'll all be good. I mentioned the MicroPython stuff. So the MicroPython site itself is here. Here's the first kind of overview documentation of everything. The quick reference page I mentioned is this one. Has kind of all the pins mapped out for the board, which we'll talk about quite extensively. And then short code snippets to do all the major functions are here as well. Visual Studio Code. This is what the page will look like when you get there. It will tell you, you know, basically it'll sense what your kind of computer on and say, hey, you want to download for Windows if you're on a Windows machine. You can grab that, get it installed, you're good to go. Okay. Again, both of those are free. So should be good to go. Okay. Presentation. So grab CoolTerm. So far, you have to grab Visual Studio Code, get that installed on your computer, get CoolTerm installed on your computer. All right. We also have, just so the documentation, they had those little tiny code snippets. There's also a ton of code available to you and has been all semester, and there will be more as the semester goes along, available to you on our GitHub page. Class GitHub page. So it looks like this. Let's bounce back over to the website. I'll show you. If you forget that link, you can just go to the website and there's example code. You can click any one of these directly. So let's look maybe. Let's look at this guy. Whoop, not on the internet. That's why I preloaded. So you can click to any of these directly and get to a file. If you click on this little icon here, that's their mascot. So Octocat, which is a Linux joke. You get to this page, and then inside this MicroPython folder are all those, everything that those direct links link to. Okay. In each one of those folders, there is a drawing that comes up when you open the folder, showing how to actually wire the thing up, code, and code that has a significant amount of commenting in it that explains why it's working the way it's working, not just given to you. Okay. So basically all the code we'll be talking about plus a lot more is in that folder. We'll talk about directly in class, and then there's extra, a lot of extra stuff there too. Okay. If you want to grab the kind of current snapshot of that folder, just get everything that's there at once, that's actually really easy to do on GitHub. So if you go to the GitHub website, it will end up looking something like this. If you look over here on the right-hand side, there's a button that says download zip. If you have a GitHub client installed, you probably know how to do this already, but it'll say download zip. If we zoom in on what that looks like, download zip, you can grab that and it'll grab the entire repository, every piece of code that's there. Okay. So that's one way to get started, is to have that entire folder right on your local hard drive. Okay, so that's kind of the setup. Questions so far? Okay. Let's start out. I want to start out talking about how to write Python by talking about how to write comments in Python. Okay. We'll get to why I kind of start this way in just a second. Right. Comments are completely ignored by the Python interpreter. Right. You can type whatever you want in a comment, and it's just ignored. And what they're there for is to allow you to explain your code, kind of in line with the code, for perhaps your coworkers or teammates, right? But also the future you. Okay? Why did I do this way? Why did I write the code in this order? What do these variables really mean in terms of the complete system? Okay? Because what's going to happen, even in the time frame we're in this class, we're going to do some things on Thursday that you're going to need again 3 weeks from now. Okay. And if you haven't looked at that code for 3 weeks, it's a good chance you might forget why certain things are in a certain order, what certain variables might represent. Right? So leave yourself some notes to remind you why you're doing things the way you are. Basically, you also want to think about your code and your comments in terms of explaining why you're doing something, not just what you're doing. Okay, the why is usually harder to figure out after the fact, 6 months from now, when you're looking at it again. The what you can kind of get, typically. Right? The why is harder to remember. So in Python, you can comment a single line of code by putting pound sign, or hashtag probably for you guys, hashtag in front of the line. Okay. You also can do what's called a block comment by doing triple quotes. You can start a block comment by doing triple quotes, and everything until the next triple quotes will be a comment. Okay? So that looks something like this in Python. Okay? And you'll see your text editor, Visual Studio, well, if it sees it as a comment, it highlights it a different color. So it lets you know, hey, this is a comment, this is not being interpreted. Okay? So that top one is a block comment, and you see you start with three quotes, and everything until it sees another three quotes right in a row is considered a comment. So those whole top three lines just get ignored. Okay. You can also have a single line comment starting a line, just putting the hashtag in front of it. Or you can have a comment after some kind of variable declaration or some kind of other command that's valid Python. Okay. So these are what you'll see. Commenting is also useful kind of when you're debugging or when you're trying different things. You could have two different methods to do something and comment one out so only one of them runs. And then, okay, comment the first one, second one. Right? So it's a way to kind of do quick trials as well. Okay? So you have block comments, the triple quotes, single comments with the pound sign hashtag. Right? Block comments are also a really good way to identify kind of what a file is supposed to do, what this particular file is doing. So it's good practice in that kind of initial header part of a Python file to include maybe the file name, which for you most times will be main.py. What's the purpose of this code? What is it actually doing? What's the functionality, intended functionality? You can list any other external requirements. Oh, you need this other Python file as well for this to work. Okay. You might link to some documentation on the sensor you're using or something like that in that header file. You know, what inputs might be needed. You can also spell out what the output of the code is. If they're spitting out a number, you need to explain what number it's going to spit out. Okay. Then you might also have version numbering, recent modifications, maybe contact information. Right. So a header might look, a generic header might look something like this. Okay. Where we have our file name up at the top, some couple sentence description of the functionality. Maybe some links to documentation or the sensor model that this is intended to work with. You might have a created date and then some modified information that were dates of key modifications. Okay. So you can do this as a block comment. You see, I have triple quotes at the beginning, triple quotes at the end. Right? You could also do it line by line. So most of our sample code, I actually use this format. It's kind of the one my lab uses, so that's what your code's going to look like. Right? So I just have a the comment character at the beginning of every line, so all of this is comment, just like it was in the block comment. What does that look like in practice? So here's actually the header block from one of the files in the repository right now, right? So we have a kind of two sentence description of what the script's supposed to do, right? Along with links to the hardware that it is using, the spec sheet for what it's using, the part it's meant to work with, an overview of where this kind of code maybe came from, where you can get more information about doing something similar, when it was created, hasn't really been modified any significantly, and then doesn't have any to-dos left. So let's kind of block commenting. It's nice to have these at the beginning of your file. What this can let you do is, again, you write some code now, 3 weeks from now, this is a reminder, what's this particular file supposed to do? Where did I get the information to help me write this? Include the link, not a big deal. And again, all this is just ignored, so it doesn't cost you anything having that there. Questions about comments? Okay. Reason I introduced these first is I'm a big supporter, and I push this on my grad students a lot, and hopefully they eventually get it, of this idea that's called literate programming. Okay. This is actually a formalized thing by one of the kind of giants of computer science. It's got Donald Knuth, and it's a formalized process, and there are actually languages based around this idea. For us, what it means, however, is that first what you want to do, before you write any code, is be able to write out, in just plain English, or your language of choice, doesn't have to be English, what do you want the code to do? What do I want this piece of code to actually accomplish, and what does it need to do every step of the way? Write it out in plain English. Write it as a flow chart. Literally sketch it out. Okay. Then what you should do is take that now plain English, plain whatever language you choose, outline of your code, and I will transcribe that and write all the comments for my piece of code first before I write a single line of actual Python code. So I can lay out the entire file, the order thing operations need to happen in, what arguments I expect functions to take, why they should take those functions. Right? Then once I have that clearly mapped out, then I start thinking about what's the actual syntax and functions I need to write to actually implement that idea. Okay. And the key point here is if you can't explain what you want a piece of code to do, just in plain words, you're not going to be able to write code to do it, right? You can't explain it to someone else exactly what you need this code to do. You're not going to be able to write code to do that. Okay? So I'm going to push on you guys as well to kind of follow something like this, right? Be able to explain what you want to do in just plain English before you try to write the code to do it. Okay? This, coincidentally, is very similar to what your high school English teachers, I'm sure, pushed you on. Writing outlines before you write reports, things like that, right? So think about what you need to write before you start writing it. Those are kind of separate, different thought processes. And same thing here. Thinking about the algorithm I want to implement is a different thought process than what does the syntax need to be to make that work. So breaking those out and thinking really clearly about the algorithm could make this part way, way easier and less error-prone. In some ways, this is very similar to our design process, right? I'm going to think really clearly about what the problem is, what are my customer requirements for the piece of code before I start writing stuff and designing things. It's very similar. Okay. So, let's actually start talking about syntax for Python beyond the comments now. Variables in Python, okay? So unlike Arduino or most other C-based languages, we don't need to specify what type of data a variable is, how much memory space it might need, those kind of things. Right? Python's a dynamically typed language. Basically, what that means is it will figure out how much memory it needs to store whatever you're asking it to save. X is 2 needs a certain amount of memory. X is 2.37584 needs a different size amount of memory. Okay? Python figures that out for you. okay, rather than you having to tell it. Okay. What it also means is that the type stored in any variable can change based on what you're storing in it. Okay. So we'll see that in a second. I'm going to stress this as well. I think it goes along with having that kind of literate programming idea. We'll see, give your variables meaningful names. Okay. We'll see, a variable is just X. It doesn't really help you understand what X is doing within the context of the code. So let's see some examples of that. So when you're first defining a variable, it's called a variable declaration. Python does have types of variables. You just don't have to specify them explicitly. Okay. So there are Python types that are Booleans. They're either true or false. Okay. So a Boolean would look something like this. Python sees that, hey, I'm assigning false to this variable. So I should allocate a Boolean amount of memory to store that information. Okay, so false in Python is a capital F, by the way. Keep that one in mind. Or if I had another one, I can assign this guy to true. All right. So those are Booleans. Those are good for binary conditions. All right, something's either true or false. It could be in one of two states. So, next one, really common one, is an integer, or, well, integers. Okay, so an integer looks something like that, or something like this. Okay, so I might have a motor speed that's 75%. Right. So instead of x equals 75, and then me having to figure out somehow what x means, I know right away what it's defining for my particular program. There's also what's called a float, which is short for a floating point number. Okay. They're just decimals. Okay. So a float looks something like this. Right? And a -1.0 for Python is different than a -1 without the point zero. Right? This guy is an integer. This guy makes it a float. I might have a precise motor speed or something. So, we also have strings in Python. Those are what hold text for us. Okay. They go between quotes. So, it looks something like that. Just kind of single, double quotes on each side. So, those are basically the types of variables we'll be dealing with throughout this semester. There are others. There are many others. These are kind of the core ones. Okay. Questions about any of those? Yes, sir. No. So we'll talk about variable naming in one slide, I think. Yeah. I can have all lowercase letters if I want. They do have to be one continuous block. Like, you can't have actual spaces in the names. So that's one reason why you'll see, we call this camel case, which we'll talk about again in one slide. So this is all, instead of having spaces there, right, I capitalize the intermediate letters. Yes?
Everything that's up there that you're calling variables looks different than any mathematical variable or something that I've ever seen. What do you specifically mean by variable?
So for the program, right, this is basically saying, take this number and store it here. Okay. And then so anywhere in my code, I could use this now, and the code will know that this represents that. Okay. Right? So we have, they're called variables because that could be changing. I can update this value. It can be a variable quantity. And rather than, so that brings up the question, why don't I just type this everywhere? Well, then you have really no idea what that means in some context, right? But then also you have to go find, if you want to change it, you have to go find it everywhere in your code and change the hard-coded value. Whereas if you have a variable somewhere, I can just change it once, and then everywhere this shows up, it gets propagated and changes throughout. Yeah?
So you're saying that it would read that variable and then apply that to whatever?
Well, whenever the interpreter sees this, it looks in the memory, right, and says, oh, what's stored there? And in this case, that's what's stored there. And that's true for all of these guys. Okay. So we also have the option to assign multiple variables at the same time. And we don't do this so often in here, but it can be useful if you have groups of things that kind of work together, right? So if you're writing some code, basically, for to do a house of quality in Python or something, right? We might have small, medium, and large being 1, 3, and 9. Okay? And those are grouped together because they're kind of all representing the same thing, just different values, different magnitude of that quantity. The other place you'll see it, if you're doing any kind of network programming, you might have an IP address and a port. And what this does is take, you know, the variable before the comma here, so 1, it's just like writing small equals 1, medium equal 3, large equal 9. Right. So if you could just write this out separately if you wanted to as well. Okay. But you have this option. Right. Again, we don't do this so often in this class, but be aware that if you see that, that's valid Python. So, asking about the variable naming. Again, you want to give your variables meaningful names. Right? So, for example, arm length equals 15 is way clearer than L equals 15. Right? Or delay time is 0.25 is much kind of clearer than T is 0.25. Okay? You want to pick a consistent variable style. So, the one that we'll use largely is called camel case. So arm length up there was camel case. It's called camel case because it has kind of humps in the middle. So every kind of, if you have multiple word naming, every word except the first gets a capital letter as its first letter. It's called camel case. You can also use underscores for spaces. Right? So delay time was that. So I had delay space, but I have to do an underscore time. Either one of those is valid. Generally, you want to pick a style, probably within your team, and stick to it. Common one you'll see, and what we'll kind of advocate, and is kind of common practice in Python and many other languages as well, is if something is not going to change or shouldn't be changing in your code anywhere, you can call it a constant, that's right, but usually you'll type it in all caps. Right? I'm going to set this pen number, and it should never change anywhere else in my code, whereas these guys can. So that's a note kind of to yourself. If you adopt that convention within your team and you see something like this being changed, you should probably look and say, okay, well, what's really going on here? Probably don't want to do that. So again, this is something that programmers fight about too. What's the best way to do it? Things like that. Excuse me. Did I answer your question about the variable naming? Good. All right, so we have variables. Let's talk about what's called variable scope. Okay? Variable scope. Scope, basically, really simply, is what can read and write to what variables. Okay? It'll make some more sense in a second, hopefully. Okay? If you define a variable outside of any functions or classes, we'll get to classes later too. If you define a function, a variable just in the main PY, not anywhere else, right? Outside of all that, it has what's called global scope, meaning you can read that variable from anywhere within that file. Global, you can read it anywhere. If you want to be able to write to that variable, it takes some extra syntax. But you can read a global variable in Python from anywhere. If you define a variable inside a function, which we'll talk about functions in just a second, then it's only accessible inside that function. When the function is finished, that memory is freed up, the variable is gone. And whatever was stored in it is gone. Okay? What you want to do when you're thinking about where you need to define your variables is define them to have as small a scope as needed. If you're only using a value within a function, you should define it within that function only. Okay? In other words, we want to avoid having global variables. It's really hard to debug. It creates a lot of problems, and we'll see why kind of moving forward. So variable scope. We'll talk about this, and this will come up, and we'll make those mistakes together and figure out kind of exactly what this means in context. Questions about variables? Okay. So we talked about, hey, if I define some variable inside a function, it's only available inside that function. Well, it brings up, how do we define functions in Python? Function declaration starts out something like this, right? You have def, D-E-F. And what that basically says is, hey, I'm getting ready to tell you about a function. I'm getting ready to define a function. Okay? You have to provide some name for that function, if it's a function you're writing. So in this case, I'm going to call it my multiply function. And that's the function name. That's what I'm going to use to call this function later. Okay. This particular function, you have your function name, then you're going to have some parentheses. And that parentheses are whatever information you need to pass into the function. The function is going to need to run. Right. So we have these kind of input variables. This function will take two things in and do something with them. Okay. And it has a colon at the end. That's important here. That colon says, hey, my function definition is over. We haven't said anything about what it actually does yet, right? That happens when you're on the next line. Okay? So we're going to take result. We're going to take x, our first input, multiply by y, which is the second input, and take that answer and save it in result. Then we're going to return that value back to whoever called this function. Okay. So you need a return if you want to return some number, some information back to who called you as a function. Okay. In Python, instead of having a bunch of curly brackets everywhere, if you've done C++ or C or Arduino stuff, the white space is what matters. So you saw I'm spaced, in this case, just two spaces. I typically use four. In this case, just two spaces over. So everything that's spaced two spaces over, at least, is part of that function. Okay. That's one of the reasons I really like Python, because it forces you to have kind of clean looking, easy to read code. Okay. So we're going to use this function in just a second. So in Python, the white space matters, which is a little bit unique among languages. And I also should note that all of these things have really more formal names that you can go off and learn, but if you like. Just like variables, give your function meaningful names. You can call a function, you can name a function whatever you want, but having it something meaningful can help you understand the algorithm you're trying to implement, can help someone else read your code and understand what's happening, and can help you 4 or 5 weeks from now when you're trying to understand something you wrote, too. Okay. So if we're going to use that function, okay, we have to define it first before we try to use it. So this would be in our main.py. Right? So I've defined this function, the one we just looked at. Okay, and let's say I'm going to assign some variables, and we're going to call them just A and B here, right? Ignoring my advice on smart variable names. As you can probably guess, I want to multiply these two things together. Of course, I could just multiply them, but I also wrote this pretty cool function. Okay? So to call that function, I use the name, the parentheses, and then I pass in whatever I want to send to the function. Okay? So in this case, A is 2. So A is in an X position. So A is 2 gets passed up there. Says, hey, that wherever there's an X, put that 2. That is part of A. Same thing for B. Okay. So these are position defined inputs, arguments to that function. Okay. So if I do this, my multiply function, what will be stored in C is what's returned back from the function. And so the function takes in 2 and 3, multiplies them, stores it in result, then returns what's in result back to whoever called it. So this returns us 6. Which is then saved in C for us. Okay. What is the scope of that result variable? Given what you have here, at least. What's the scope? Who? Where is it? What's? Where is it defined at? It's actually local to that function. Right, it's defined, result is defined inside that function only. Right? When we return the information that's stored in that variable, and that's what gets saved here, not result itself. Okay. So after that function is called, after this line, result is gone. Okay?
It's local to C.
No, it's local to the function. My multiply function. Yeah, it's defined in the function. It's not defined globally. What's the scope of A and B, given what you've seen here? Those guys are global. Okay. So, one nice thing about Python being dynamically typed is that multiply function would work with other types as well. So if I wanted to multiply two floats together, right, if I'm writing C code, I have to do some fancy stuff here. In Python, that's really easy for me. I still can just pass, you know, A equals 1.2, B equals 3.75, pass those into the function, I'm going to get back again the result. That's right. So I define it. I say, hey, I'm gonna do this multiplication, and it wouldn't be just multiplication, obviously, but have some concrete steps you need to repeat many times. So rather than type those out every time, basically, you do it once, define a function, and every time you call this, it runs that code and gives you, in this case, whatever you return back. Yes, sir?
So would it be best to define all your functions like at the beginning?
You have, yeah. You guys with me? Functions? Questions about functions? Okay. Basically, you want to use them for the reasons we just talked about, right? You also want to aim for a function having a single function. It's kind of a really common beginner mistake to write some function and it does 15 things, right? That creates problems, right? If you have a function that only doing a single function, right, it's way easier to debug what's going wrong when something's going wrong, right? Each block is pretty simple. And it's kind of just up to me to glue them together in the right way. Right? Whereas if I have some big function, where it's going wrong is much harder to find sometimes. Okay? What it also does for you is make your code way more reusable. Right? So you have some function that has 15 steps in it. It's much less likely that that's going to apply somewhere else than something that's just doing one thing. Right? So I could use those singular kind of one functions. There's actually a style of program that limits that. One kind of one functions make it way easier to debug, way easier to use. Okay. The other thing this does for you, instead of typing out things every time I need to do them, right, using a function, basically I make sure it works one time and then it should work every time after that. Right? So again, decreases likelihood of code, and also using functions can make your code more readable. Yes, sir?
So you're making, like, if you said you had like a multi-step process, you make a function for each step?
Yes.
And then you can just keep reusing them?
That's right. So we'll see that in the next slide. Okay. And so it makes your code more readable if you have functions, because you can kind of hide all the little small details that don't really matter for the main algorithm. Right? So in that sense, it also makes the program logic easier to follow. Again, you want to give them good names. So this is an example of using functions the whole way down, right? So inside wait for start button, that's a function. It doesn't take any arguments. That's a function that's sitting there waiting for the start button of the track. And there's four lines of code or five lines of code that's there doing that. Okay? Once I get that, right, I come down and wait a little while, and then I drive forward for 4 seconds. Right? This drive forward function that I've written somewhere might have a whole block of code that does all the things I need to do to make my robot drive forward. Right? Same thing with drive backwards. Might be the opposite of that. I might have some function that's called rotate arm on my final robot, right? And there might be some big block of code that I have to actually do to make my arm rotate, right? But rather than have those big blocks of code here every time I need to do them, right, make sure it works once, right? And then every time I call drive forward, it should be working. But this also is really easy to follow. I can look at just this and see probably what this robot should be doing. Whereas that's much harder to do if I had a big block of 15 lines of code here that were necessary to make me drive backwards. Yes, sir?
So way above this, you would have to define?
They'd all have to be defined. Yeah, I'm not sure on the function definitions. Right. But this is maybe the core algorithm, right? I'm going to drive forward, rotate an arm, wait a little while, rotate it back, drive backwards. Right? There's a lot of robots in this class, competition, that do basically just that. Right? But what happens in these functions, right? This makes it really easy to understand what's happening at the high level for your system. Yes, sir?
So at this point, you're calling functions?
Yes, these are calling functions.
And this is what it would look like? If you predefine everything, this is kind of how it should look?
Yeah, so,
like a step process.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, sir?
So like, you have drive backwards
too? Yep.
Yeah,
so that depends on, of course, how you've defined what's in here, right? So this is a function that we wrote, hypothetically, that handles all the low-level stuff to actually make the system drive backwards. So if it could take, that code was precise enough that it took a float here rather than an integer, yeah, you could pass a float. Yes, sir?
I have a question about, like, the flow mode of the variable.
Yes.
Could you have, say, like, you have A and B as a little variable,
mm-hmm. Yes, that's the other reason you use local variables. Yeah, so in that case, if you have all global variables, you start having to do tricky things with your names. Yes, sir?
Can you, like, overlap functions, like have things going off simultaneously?
So can you have things driving forward and rotating the arm at the same time? There are ways to do that with the board you have. There are ways with actually a completely different set of firmware for the board you have that make it really parallel. That's a little bit beyond the scope of what we're going to do. However, the way your kind of kit we give you is set up, once you tell a motor to start running, it will keep running until you tell it to stop. So in that sense, you can do things in parallel. And we'll get to a lot more detail on how to go through that moving forward. Okay. So we talked a lot about debugging code. How do I make sure, if I've written all these functions and I try to run this and it doesn't work, not doing what I want it to do, how do I figure out where the mistake is? Okay. One is to really read the error message you're getting if you're getting an error message. If there's some syntax error, Python is pretty good about telling you exactly what line number of your code it's in and what the error actually is. Okay. So actually read the error message you get. Don't just see red and start panicking and changing stuff. Okay. That's a hard way to figure out how to actually fix that problem. Once you've done that, and hey, okay, I've got rid of all the syntax errors, it actually runs, but it's still not doing what I expect it to do. It's a harder one to debug than just syntax errors. How do we handle that case? The one thing to remember, and I think is the key to really understanding how to both write code and debug code, is that the computer is only going to do exactly what you tell it, nothing more, nothing less. And I do mean exactly. So if you tell it to do something weird, it's going to try to do something weird. Okay? It's only going to do exactly what you tell it. Okay? So when you're trying to debug, you have to kind of try to get into that framework, right? And don't make assumptions about what you're asking the thing to do, because the computer doesn't do that. Right? The computer's only working through exactly what you're telling it, nothing more, nothing less. Okay. Computer itself is dumb. So when you're doing this, what you can do is walk through, and we'll have some examples of us doing that in a few minutes, walk through line by line and ask yourself, what is happening on this line only? Step by step by step, explicitly what's going on. Okay. Oh, and this line A is getting defined as 2. And this line B is getting defined as 3. In this line, our function is getting called. Okay, A and B go there. They go up into the function step by step by step. We're also able, because we have that REPL, to kind of print out information while the code is running to help us debug. Okay? So we'll have these print statements we're getting ready to talk about. So you don't have to guess at what's going on with your code. You can be printing stuff out to that REPL and getting information about where it's at in the logic, what's running right now, what the values of certain variables might be. So this is the second big thing. One, the computer is dumb. It's going to do exactly what you tell it, nothing more, nothing less. And two, don't guess at what's happening. Give yourself information. Right? You can use these print statements to print out what's the current status of different things, different places in the code. Okay. We're going to print those out. We're going to be connected to the board via that REPL we talked about. Cool term looks something like this when you boot it up. And we're connected. Okay. This guy allows the Pi board to communicate with your computer. It's communicating over serial communication, USB cable. So we can use this REPL for prototyping, debugging, and execution monitoring. Right. So we've talked mainly about the last two. You can also use it to kind of run one line at a time and help you figure out, okay, this line needs to come next, and these are the timings I need to follow, et cetera. Excuse me. So let's talk about those print statements. They're going to be really valuable for you when you're trying to figure out how things work, what you need to do. So let's define a function. Okay. We're going to define a function called print some stuff. What kind of arguments does print some stuff have? What input does it need based on what you see here? What's inside the parentheses? Nothing. So I don't need to give it any information. It has everything it needs to run kind of self-contained. Okay? So the print statement is just print, parentheses, and then whatever you want to print, inside quotes, if it's a string. Okay? So in this case, whenever I call this function print some stuff, it's just going to print hello, Dr. Vaughn, and then return to whoever called it. It doesn't return any information. That's why we don't have a return statement here. So actually, a lot of the functions that we write in this class, because it's just controlling a motor or something like that, we don't necessarily need to return any information back to who called it. It's just, hey, go run the motor. I'm going to save a random number. Don't worry about the right side of that yet. One sec. Just think this is some random number that the Pi board generated for me. We'll talk about the PYB dot in a minute. You have a question or are you stretching?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you need that variable back, that data back, the function generated. Okay. So I say some random number. I have a print some stuff function. If I have some variable, I can print that variables directly in Python. So if I wanted to print out to the REPL and see what the value of random number was, I could just do that. And it's going to print out 42 or whatever to the REPL when it gets to this print statement. I could also call that print some stuff function. And because it's not returning anything, I don't need anything on the kind of left-hand side of this equation, if you will. Right. So I just run this and it doesn't return anything and then it moves on. Okay. Understand the basics of print? Right. I can print out strings. Right? Remember, anything inside quotes is a string. I can print out strings. I can print out variables directly. You guys maybe see a problem with just printing the variables directly? If I have some big long piece of code, I'm just printing numbers out. Yeah, I don't know what it's just a bunch of numbers. It's hard to remember which one is where and where it's at. So we want to print some information about this random number, but we want to add something that maybe identifies that, hey, that's random number is currently blah, 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 blah. Okay? We can do that in Python using this format method. There's a great overview at this link, but the syntax is basically this. Basically the print statement, okay, and I have some string, and then whatever variable I have, I'm going to include some information in these curly quotes inside the string. I'm going to close my string and do dot format in the variable name. Okay. That's going to make more sense right now. Okay. So if I want to print an integer, I can do that. The colon D says, hey, what I'm going to give you, what, fill in here and print this out, is an integer. And I can make things prettier if I want. That's just going to print integer 42, right? I could always plant the plus or minus sign. So if I knew that number was alternating between positive and negative, and I always wanted to see which sign it was for sure, I could include just a colon plus D. I'm going to get plus 42 out. If I always wanted it to take up four spaces, I can tell it to do that. If I wanted always to take up four spaces and then kind of pad zeros in front, I can do that too. So let's take a look. I think I have this one. Nope, I don't, but I can get to it. So, I can print the integer out, and what I get out would be that. Okay. I can print that out, put a plus sign. I always get a plus or minus, right? If that was minus 42, it would have told me, hey, that's minus 42 now. I can print that out. I can say always take up four spaces of text. There's kind of, you see it's spaced over because it has only two numbers of the number. It has those two extra blank spaces. I could print that out and do the four spaces. Oops. But fill with zeros in front. Okay. Any ideas why either one of those last two might be helpful? Yeah, you're all lined up nice. Right. So it can be way easier to see things up as they're updating if they're just kind of a column of things coming down, right? So this is a way you can line things up quite nice and help you with your debugging as well. And that's why I'm showing it to you. We could do something similar with floats. So float, it's F for float. That one's a little bit easier to understand. So I could print out it's pi. I could, for a float, I could specify how many decimal places I want to print out, too. Right? So if I want only one of the first four decimal places, I do the colon dot 4f. That's only going to print out to four decimal places. Okay? Or I could do something similar and say, hey, I want to take up nine spaces and use two of those for the actual decimal. Okay? So I could do something like that. Or I can pad with zeros for that one as well. So maybe let's take just a look at that real quick, too. So there's our first one. Right, just prints out the float and the whole kind of representation of it. Right. And what that would do, if I had a true float here, it's going to print out some representation, some long representation of that. I can tell it to print only four decimal places. Whoa, what am I missing here? Not too big. Dot 4F. Yep, there we go. Sorry. Thank you. There we go. So now I'm printing out the four decimal places. Right? Remember, it's only going to do exactly what you tell it. I was telling it to take up at minimum four spaces, not four decimal places. So it was doing what I was telling it. Okay. I could do, so we had 9.2 in the notes. So take up nine total spaces and two of them being the decimal place. So that's what happened. Again, this is useful to help you line things up as you're looking at these variables running by. Yes, sir.
So if we want to use a code, like a syntax from the GitHub thing, is it okay to copy and paste it directly or do you want us to like type it up?
So, the example code from GitHub, can I copy and paste? Do I need to type everything out manually? I think that depends on what the purpose of using the code is. If you're trying to really learn it, I think it's helpful to type it out yourself at least once, some of it. If you feel like you have a good understanding of what's happening and are using the code 6 weeks from now in your final project, feel free to copy and paste. It's there for you. Yes, sir.
So this print, this is just a visualization of it. This doesn't actually even read and do anything.
No, it doesn't do anything. It just prints it out to the REPL for you so you can see it. Right, so that's what I mean. Like, we could have this somewhere in our code, and it would print out something. When it gets to this line, it would print out something. And we'd know, okay, right now the value, the motor speed is 32 or something. Rather than having to, yeah, like a log. Rather than having to guess, okay, we told the motor to go at this speed or something. Right. So I think we don't want, and the kind of whole point here is you don't want to guess at what's happening. You have the ability to get information and feedback from the system about what its current state is. There are also some special characters that also can help you out. So for example, we can add a new line, right? So I can have two different variables in this case. Show that case. And again, this can help you when you're trying to read and parse a bunch of information, right? Oops. Pull that up to the top so you can see it better. So that new line, that slash n, is saying, hey, kind of hit return on your typewriter is one way to kind of think about it, right? Go to the next line. Right? So they're going to be on two different lines now, right? I can do a tab as well, slash t. And that's going to tab one space over. And again, it helps with kind of lining things up. If you have a stream of numbers coming at you based on what your machine is doing, you can look at those, and it's easier to read if they're not switching horizontally every time based on the value. Okay. Questions about print statements? String formatting. Yep.
So the REPL that you're talking about,
yep.
It's going to be a separate window that's going to be pulled up, and while this code is running, it's going to be connected to that, and it's going to be spit.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's a separate window, and the code that you write on your computer is actually running on the microcontroller.
Okay.
It's just spitting out these strings over the serial, the USB cable,
okay,
that new program can, the other program can monitor. Right.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. Let's talk about the basic control structures. And these show up in pretty much every language on the planet. And we'll talk about the Python syntax, but this way of thinking shows up everywhere. Okay. Basically, we need a control program flow. Right. If a sensor reading is this, do that thing. Right. If the pressure in my line is over that, do something different. It's kind of the core of what we think about programming to be, really, right? Conditional execution. So we're going to talk about three main ones. If, then, we're going to talk about for loops, and we're going to talk about while loops. Okay. Before we talk really about those loops themselves, we need to figure out how do we actually determine kind of conditions, this conditionality, right? And any of these, really, we're going to need something that evaluates to a Boolean. Some condition. This is either true, this condition is true, or this condition is false. So in Python, we do that, and this is pretty similar across languages too. To compare x and y, we use two equal signs. Okay. So in this case, x equal y is true if they're equal, and false if they're not. Okay. So let's do that way, maybe. X equal 2. Let's make y equal 2 first. So if we do x equal y, we get a true back. Okay. If y happened to be 5 instead, and we try x equal y there, we should get false back. They're not equal anymore. Okay. So we need the two equal signs to do comparison. Right. If we don't do that, right, what we're doing is assigning. If we were doing that x, y, we'd be assigning whatever's in y to be in x, too, if you have one equal sign. So that's actually a common mistake. That's just a typo that pretty much everyone that writes these comparisons does at some point in their career, and probably pretty regularly. So we have that comparison, right? We also have not equal. So the not equal is true if they're different. Yes, sir.
Going back to the comparison, like, why is that? What is the purpose of that? Why do you need to tell you if it's true or not?
Hang on to that for two slides and see if you still have a question. And let me know if you still do. Okay. So, we have all these comparisons. Less than works like you'd expect. Greater than equal. Less than or equal. All work like you'd expect. And syntax similar to how you might expect. So, we have these comparisons, and all these conditionals we talk through work on some structure something like this. Let's talk first about an if-then. Okay. An if-then sound it works and does things just like it sounds. If something is true, then do some other stuff, right? So an if statement in Python looks like this. Right? So you have if, and we're going to say condition one equal true. If whatever's in that parentheses evaluates to being true, then I'm going to run all of the code that's indented underneath it. Okay? You need the if, right? You need the colon on the right-hand side. And then you need some kind of expression in those parentheses that evaluates to being either true or false. Okay? So that's all you need for an if, right? You'd have to write some code there to do what you wanted to if it was true. Well, that's enough, right? But sometimes I have more than one condition. If the sensor reading is this, do this set of actions. Otherwise, if it's this in this range, do this set. If it's in this other range, do this information, right? So we need to be able to chain these things together. So in Python, I have another condition called elif. Okay? And one way to kind of think about this, if that's true, do that stuff else. If this condition is true, do what's indented underneath it. Okay? So everything indented underneath the second, that elif, would only run if the first condition is false, but the second one is true.
Okay?
Yep. So what's here would only run if that condition, the first one, is false, right? If it's true, what gets run is there, and then it bounces out to the end of all this and keeps going. Okay. So the first one is false. It comes to the elif and checks it. Okay. If it's true, then it runs what's indented underneath it. Okay. And I can have as many elifs as I want. Okay. I also can have one more type of structure. That's an else. Right. And the else is what gets run if everything is false. So if both condition one is false, it checks this one, checks condition two, oh, that was false too, then it comes down to the else by itself and runs whatever is there. Okay. So let's look at a more concrete example maybe. Okay. So you might have a counter in your code. So that counts the number of times you've done something. So I'm incrementing this counter somewhere, right? So this, if I've done this thing less than 10 times, I want to do this stuff. Okay? If I've done it more than, greater than, equal 20 times, I want to do this. This code that's indented here. Otherwise, I want to do some other stuff. Okay? You guys kind of with me on that? Right. So then, take a look at this and tell me what's going to happen. Okay, so it's going to print. So right, let's do this. Let's look line by line. Okay, so the first line, A gets defined as 2. Right? We store 2 inside A. So we get down to the next line, the if. Okay, so is 2 greater than 5? No, that's a false statement. Okay, so it doesn't run what's indented there. It moves down to the elif. It says, well, A is 2. Is 2 equal to 2? True. That condition is true. So then it runs what's indented here, and then finishes. Okay. So that prints out. Oh, wrong way. does this print, runs this print statement. Okay. How about this one? They'll never ever leave. Right. Okay. So, so we said, hey, well, A is 2, B is 3. We get to the first print, the first if statement. Is 5 greater than 5? No. So that evaluates the false. So we come down to the next thing. Okay. Is 3 minus 2 equal to 2? No. So that's false as well. So we don't run that code. So we come to the next one, that's an else. So neither one of those was true, we run what's here. Okay? Yes, sir?
There's always one if, and then everything else is the...
Yeah, the if is needed, everything else is optional. Yeah. So you could have just the if by itself, if you wanted. And you could have a bunch of elifs if you wanted to. So where this might show up in your final project, for example, you're going to have to sense a start signal. Right? And whether you sense the start signal or not, that's kind of a Boolean, right? It's you either sensed it or you didn't. Right? It's a 1 or 0. It's true or false. So you could have some code somewhere that is trying to sense the start signal, and then when it senses the start signal, it sets that value to true. Okay? Then, okay, so that's going to be true. When we get to this if, remember, we just need a Boolean inside those parentheses. It has to be true or false. Well, what happens here? What is the value of sent start signal? It's true, right? So what's in those parentheses evaluated to true, so I run what's underneath. Okay. So if you have a Boolean variable, you can pass that and use that directly, is what I'm pointing out here. So whatever's in those parentheses, if it evaluates to true, which in this case it does, right? What's underneath is going to run. I might have an else there as well. So I could have just the if. I might have an else that if it didn't sense it, then it's checking it again somewhere down here. Yes, sir?
If you have the if, it doesn't signal. We'll just keep looking for that signal?
No, it will not. Okay, let's go back. In this case, right, it's true, so it would run. If it was false, it checks it. It says, hey, that's false. I'm not going to run what's under here. It would run whatever's next after the if block. So if you had a bunch of other code down here, it would start running whatever's next. Because we haven't told it explicitly to go back and check that variable again. Right? Well, that's where doing this would come in. If that happened to be false, I hadn't sensed the start signal yet, I need to have something here to check the signal. And then something kind of looping over the whole thing. Okay. If then, you guys got it? Yeah, that's pretty straightforward. It works like an if then, right? Like you might expect. Talk about for loops. The syntax in Python for a for loop looks something like this. So it's for. In this case, counter is some variable, and then n some kind of sequence. And we'll talk about what that sequence thing can be. So for loop is good for running a prescribed number of times. I want to do this 10 times. I want to do this 5 times. Okay? So in this for loop, this counter is a variable that gets incremented each time the loop runs. So whatever we're running in the for loop, we get to the end of it, it comes back to the top and increments that counter. That sequence, we have a few options for what it is. Probably the most common one in this class is range and then some number. Okay. And basically what this gives you is a list of variables between, a list of numbers between 0, it's 10 numbers, but it starts at 0. So you go 0 to 9. Okay. So this for loop would loop 10 times. Okay. And the way this works, you get to this the first time, right? It defines this. And defines counter equal to the first value, runs what's in there. Okay. Gets to the end, comes back up here, says, is there anything left in my range? Well, yeah, I have 1 to 9 still left to go. Okay. It takes 1, gives it to the counter, runs the loop, gets to the end, comes back again, checks. Do I have anything left in my sequence? Well, in this case, yeah, I have 2 to 9 left still. So I assign 2, the next value, to counter, run what's ever here. I keep that doing that. So I get to 9. Okay? I have 9, counter's 9, this runs. I get back up here, range doesn't have anything left in it. My sequence is empty now. So the for loop is finished. It doesn't run what's inside, it runs whatever's next. Okay? So that's a pretty common one. Let's look at that one, maybe. For counter, range, 10. Still can't type. I'm going to print counter equal to counter. Did it right? Nope, I did not. Sorry. And I missed a quote. Okay. So what's going to happen here? Who wants to walk me through it? What happens the first time through? It's going to print 0. Remember, this range starts at 0. The 0 index, we say. So the first time through, it sets up range to say, hey, there's 0 to 9 inside range. Takes the first one, assigns it to counter. So its counter is equal to 0 right now. Okay? It's going to come down to so there's still stuff left in range. So it's going to print what's inside. In this case, we're going to print counter equals, and I'm going to use my string formatting. And it's going to be equal to 0, right? And it's going to finish that. Okay, so now it's going to come back up and check the for loop again. Is there anything left in my sequence? We got to have 1 to 9, like we just talked through. Right? So it should print this how many times? What should it print? 0, 1, 2, all the way to 9. So that's a for loop with that range. Again, this is probably the most common construction you guys will use. I want to do something 3 times. This is a way to do that. Right. So instead of print, it could be run motor, move servo, check sensor. And I want to do it 3 times or 10 times or whatever. Rotate wheel 3 times. Yes, sir.
So you would use this function instead of pasting whatever other function 3 times?
Yes, I could do this. I could have counter equal 0, print counter. Counter equal 1, print, right? But this is a way to loop through that. In Python, you can also loop over other kinds of sequences, right? So whatever goes in that sequence doesn't have to be that range, right? In this case, it's a list of types of pies. Okay. So what happens the first time through this loop? Yeah, I think apple pies are delicious. Okay, apple pies gets back to the top. What happens? I think cherry pies. It grabs the next thing, puts it in the pie, and then we print it out. Exactly. So you get exactly what you guys were expecting. Good job. So you could use this if you wanted to run your motor a certain sequence of speeds, for example. I want to run at 25% throttle, and then 75%, and then 42%. Every time through this list, I'm going to get one of those numbers. Right? So I could do that in a for loop. Okay. I also can be a little bit fancier and do it this way. If you add this enumerate around a list, this keyword, it'll give you an index as well. So in this case, what this prints is not just the pie number, but what number element it was in the list. Right. So in this case, again, the 0 indexed So the first time through, it grabbed the first element, which is apple. It said, well, hey, again, zero index, so the first element's zero. Right? So the zero pi in the list is apple. And loops through that way. So those are the three main types of kind of for loops. Again, you'll probably use range most often, but know these other ways are there. They could lead to way more efficient code, typically, if you're aware of them. Questions about for loops?
Could you have like two variables in
there? What do you mean by two variables?
You could have a different types of pi and like how you give up the pi in there.
Yeah, you could have them as part of the same list. If you're trying to pull out both of those at the same time, it gets a little bit trickier. But it's not hard to do. So in fact, most, if you look Python tutorials for for loops, most will have something like that and show you how to do it.
So
yes, sir.
Let's say you're going, under the first time, you put an open and close function, and then it would rerun both of those?
Yes. Okay. Yep. Okay. We're almost there with our last main category, while loops. Okay. While loops do basically what they sound like as well. They're going to run this code while some condition is true. And it's going to keep running as long as that condition is true. The syntax for that looks like this. So a while loop begins with a check of the condition. Okay. If that condition is true, then it's going to run whatever's indented underneath that while loop. Okay. Once it gets to the end of whatever's indented, it goes back up and looks at the while again. It says, is that condition still true? If it is, it runs that while loop again. Gets to the end, bounces back up. Is the condition I'm checking, whatever it happens to be, still true? Oh, it's not true anymore, so skip all this stuff and run whatever next. Okay. The other thing to remember about a while loop, if that condition is not true the first time through, it never runs. Okay, so it's checked before the first run, too. Okay. So let's look at, again, that's just at the beginning of each iteration. Let's look at an example. What does this guy do? Okay. You have a print, even numbers. Where does it start, though? Zero, right? When it gets to that print statement the first time, its value is zero. Right? And it's going to stop, so we can step through this, right? So the first time it goes, index is zero, right? So the conditional check is zero less than 10. Is that true? Yeah, that's a true statement in there. So it runs what's indented underneath the while loop. So it does the print, we fill in the index, so that's zero this time, and then after we print, we take index and make it equal to index plus 2. So index is now 2. Okay? And we're finished with what's inside the while loop. So the while loop structure goes back and checks, hey, is index, which is now 2, less than 10? That's still true. Comes down, prints index equal 2, takes index and stores 2 plus 2, that's now 4. Yeah? You loop back up to check the condition again. Is index, which is now 4, less than 10? Still true, right? So like you guys expected, we get to this. When it gets to 10, the one thing you may have missed, if it gets to 10, right, 10 is not less than 10. So it doesn't actually print 10. It prints 0 to 8. Okay. Of course, we can combine these structures as well. What does that do? Anybody? Yeah, go for it.
It would run through, check it at zero.
Yep.
Not, it would skip the if, since the if is false.
That's right.
Add one and do that until index equal 3, then yep. It would run the if.
Runs the if, so that when it gets to 3, index equal 3, that's true. It prints this out, then what happens? So once the if is done, right, remember the if only matters what's run. So what happens after the if is finished, it just comes down and starts running what's next. So now I have 3, or index equals 3 plus 1, so I store 4 there. So it still loops until 9, but we're only printing out when it's 3. Right? So it just prints out 3. Whoops. Just prints out 3. Let's look at that one. We can check our understanding. Okay, so that's the code we were just looking at, right? And it should just print out index equal 3. Yes, sir. Well, maybe, you know, this is a little bit of a contrived example, you're right, but maybe I'm doing something else with what index later, and I only want to move my servo arm when the sensor reading is 3. But I want to be doing other stuff each loop through. Right. So in this case, we're, you know, think about these print statements standing in for other stuff you could be doing. Just the print statements are easy for us to see and debug right now. Yeah.
Does it have a condition?
What do you mean? Which loop, though? There's two conditions there. So if I had just while by itself. So you're asking, what if I did this? Is that what you're asking about? Oops. Okay. So that's going to yell at you. And hey, it's saying, and this is the kind of error you're going to get, so that's why I wanted to go ahead and do that. It's going to say, hey, you got something wrong right here. Can't do that. Okay? I can, however, if I wanted, make this run forever. When is this true? Always. Right? So this while is going to be true every time it gets checked. Right? So if I run this, right, it's still just going to print once, but you'll see that it just keeps running now. It's running forever and ever right now until I manually break it. So it was running and running and incrementing index the whole time. In fact, I probably, how many times did it run? Right. So I was sitting there running as fast as it could. Okay. So we got that one. We had the if. Okay. What happens here? So just don't worry about this too much. Know that it just kind of waits there a little while before it moves on to the next line. Right. Right. So I have this while keep running, right? So I set keep running true to begin with, right? So it's true when it gets to the check the first time. So what's in that while loop's going to run? Right? I've set index be 0 the first time, right? Because it's going to start out at 0 where I'm running. So it gets here, keep running is true. So it says, oh, I'm going to run what's indented underneath, right? So I print running. I get down to the if, which is the next thing. Is 0, which is index greater than or equal to 10. Is it? No. So that evaluates the false. Right? So I don't do what's underneath the if. I move to this next line, which is kind of wait a little while. Then I add 1 to index and save it in the same place. Okay? Notice that this is indented all the way out. So I don't run that yet. I loop back up. It's keep running true. Yeah, we haven't changed it. Still true. So we run the while loop again. So index time, index is 1 now, right? So 1 is not greater than 10. Kind of repeat that process. Right? So if we do that one. That's right. Yes. So bounce that up to the top of the screen. There you go. And you kind of see the indentation a little bit better here when it's 4 spaces. Right. So the print over there, and in fact, the Visual Studio, you can show those how many spaces and things too to make sure it's lined up. Right. So in this case, we'll get what we were expecting. Okay. So it prints running while it's in the loop. And then once that condition in the while loop is false, then it bounces out and runs whatever is after the while loop immediately following. So in that case, it prints stop the very last time. Okay. So you could do very easily something like this. Your code for your robot could look very easily something like this, right? Where you have keep running true while you want things to keep happening. Read some sensor and set keep running to false if the sensor value is out of some range or something. Okay. So you saw what that did. Okay. So for next week, okay, you install Visual Studio Code as we talked. Okay. Install CoolTerm. Hang on a minute, please. Let me finish talking. Okay. Install CoolTerm. Okay. Look through these notes again before you come to class Thursday. You go out and party this weekend. Refresh this before you come back. All right. Take a look at the MicroPython starting guide on the website. It's pretty well done. If you read that and read through that before class on Thursday, you're going to be way ahead of the game. If you review these notes again before Thursday, you're going to be ahead of the game. Okay. On Thursday next week, if you have a laptop, feel free to bring it. If you have a laptop, you can bring your kit along as well. So we're basically going to be live coding for the next couple weeks. All right. If you don't have a laptop, that's cool. Just be ready to look over somebody's shoulder and kind of pair program with them. You guys write code together. Make sure you're talking with people. Okay, now you're back.